We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, former co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right. No Maria this morning. She's. You guys are trading off on being under the weather.
Exactly. So now I'm on top of the weather, and she's not.
All right. Well, plenty to cover, but not a lot in the local scene this last week. But.
No, although we did get the entertaining media spectacle this week of having a city councilwoman arrested.
And actually, for what you would think she'd get arrested for, I was gonna make a joke, not for what you think. But no, she's been very consistent on her actions and words. So
no, the interesting part of Shama Sawant being arrested in a civil disobedience action in SeaTac over the $15 minimum wage fight that is still going on there. We have had in the city of SeaTac, voters passed Proposition 1 year and a half ago now, over a year ago now, and the airlines then sued, saying, "Well, city of SeaTac doesn't have any jurisdiction over." And mind you, the unions and workers behind the SeaTac proposition went to the voters of SeaTac in the first place because for years and years, the Port of Seattle said, "Well, we don't have authority to enforce minimum wage in the airport. That goes to the city of SeaTac." So they got the law passed in the city of SeaTac. So then the airline said, no, it's the Port of Seattle's jurisdiction. And so the Port of Seattle decided earlier this year to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And so the airlines are now suing, saying that the Port of Seattle does not have jurisdiction. Maybe there is no jurisdiction there at all. They're a law unto themselves. That seems to be the legal theory. But in any event, there was a protest this past Wednesday at Alaska Airlines headquarters in SeaTac. It's actually a trade group, not just one airline, that is behind the lawsuit. But Alaska is much of the money behind the lawsuit, and also is the one of the airlines who has their actual headquarters in Seattle, and so they were the target. And three airport workers and Councilmember Sawant were the people who were arrested there, and it was quite remarkable watching the civility police doing their hand wringing and their smelling salts and getting a case of the vapors over the sheer incivility of a city councilwoman actually trying to stand up for something she believed in. That didn't involve giving a lot of money to developers, so. So you had a remarkable amount of commentary in the media along the line of, this was not particularly appropriate. It seemed to be a very popular action to take with actual people who were on the internets and Twitter and social media, but you wouldn't know it from the newspaper comment threads and such. But the interesting part of it was the media coverage, not so much from the scolds, the people like Jill Connolly who called Sawant a socialist diva in terms of civil disobedience, exactly what civil disobedience historically in this country has done, which is draw attention to issues that aren't getting a lot of local media coverage. In this case, the airline's effort to subvert the will of voters and of the workers. But particularly interesting in this, it was an outstanding example of media bias in the Seattle Times. And the Times, of course, has over the past several years, since the disappearance of the print version of the Post-Intelligencer in 2008, they've always had a conservative-leaning editorial board and editorial page opinion section, but the actual news coverage, which is supposedly objective, has been steadily been colored by that same editorial bias over the years, and more egregiously so over the years. But this is a particularly egregious episode this week, and I actually broke it out online for people who are interested at jav.org or on Facebook. But basically, you had the quote in the Times, and I'll read the quote directly, that speaking to reporters on Wednesday, Sawant said it was her obligation as a public servant to exercise civil disobedience and risk arrest. This is how you show political leadership, she said on Wednesday. Well, that's actually, my first thought was that kind of roll my eyes because Shama has been known to, you know, engage in some hyperbole in the course of her career. And really, public servants have obligations to risk arrest. That's an interesting statement. You could debate it, certainly. It presumes that there's going to be injustices and that those injustices rise to the level that you would want to risk arrest to try and draw attention to them. It presumes that you're an outsider rather than an insider. And, of course, elected officials are the consummate insiders. So a debate can be had. But the problem is that wasn't actually Sawant's quote. Cairo TV, among others, had the full quote, which was as follows. When workers are showing such enormous courage to fight for not only themselves but other workers, they're fighting for everybody, then my duty as an elected public servant is to be right there with them. This is about showing political leadership. So she didn't say anything about... first of all, she made reference to elected public servant, not just public servant. She says duty, not obligation. She didn't say anything about civil disobedience or risking arrest. She just said it was her duty to stand with them. But what it basically comes down to, and of course she's identified as a socialist because she's always identified as a socialist in these news accounts because let's face it, for a lot of people that still colors their perception of what they're going to read following it. It's kind of a subtle way of showing, rather than simply saying, that she is a diva. She is out there accountable to nobody in particular except whoever she decides she wants to be accountable for, and out there on her own and really not acting on her own. Her original statement was an if-then statement. If these people are taking this action, then I should stand with them, as opposed to just saying, well, I think everybody's duty as a public servant is to go out and do this, which is not what she said at all. It was a very egregiously misleading use of what ostensibly is an accurate quote, but by condensing the quote, they managed to change the meaning of it completely. And so that's your Media 101, Literacy 101 statement in, here's one weird trick to make a local elected official that you don't like look potentially bad in the eyes of people who think that standing up for that they believe in is a bad thing when they don't believe in what you believe in or something.
All right. So moving on to national
news.
There's
a lot of national news this week, though.
Yeah, and everybody's like waiting for the grand jury to announce their findings for Ferguson.
Yeah, there's two stories this week which can be summarized as nation prepares to be overrun by angry hordes of brown people. The first of them is Ferguson, of course, and pretty much coordinated in cities around the country, including Seattle, I might add. Both federal authorities and local authorities have been bracing themselves for the grand jury in St. Louis County in Missouri to probably fail to indict the officer who shot Michael Brown in August. And it was leaked yesterday that officer is considering resigning, and that's part of a plea bargain, and he'll only resign if he is, in fact, not indicted, as though his resignation is then going to somehow mollify people's anger around this, when in fact, as tragic and horrific as that shooting of an unarmed black teenager was in August, it's really been everything since then that is the bigger story in this, how there has been a systematic institutional racism that has protected that officer and that has demonized the people who've protested that shooting at every step of the way, both locally and nationally, over the past 4 months. And we're seeing that again in the run-up to the decision by the grand jury, where there's just sort of a widespread assumption that, well, of course, it involves police shooting and involves angry brown people, and therefore there are going to be riots and it's going to be destructive. And, of course, police, who were the problem in the first place, don't forget, will be justified in using whatever violent force, which was the problem in the first place, don't forget, that they feel is necessary in order to contain those angry brown people. And one piece of this yesterday was particularly telling. Missouri authorities yesterday refusing to make significant concession to rules of engagement that were proposed by the coalition in St. Louis that is also planning to respond to this. Those rules of engagement were basically asking the cops to do things like there were 19 of them, and it was a set of requests to do things like not use armored vehicles, not use tear gas and rubber bullets. The police refused all this. What they did agree to do was prioritize preservation of human life, which is, you know, mighty white of them. Literally, it's the sort of thing where, and not necessarily something actually that they will honor anyway. It's something that is very, very worrisome that after all of the publicity that has gotten over the last several months and all of the criticism, not just of the original shooting, but of the cover-up of that shooting, the way Brown's body was handled, the way the evidence was covered up, the way officials lied in order to change the published scenario, the way the media coverage of the autopsy results was distorted and misrepresented, the way protesters were demonized, the way the military grade weaponry, and not just in St. Louis County but across the country, has been brought, the way police have been militarized has very much been brought to the fore by this whole sequence of events over the past few months. And we've seen additional publicity now for any number of other police shooting of unarmed, mostly youth of color, over the past several months. In fact, we had another one this past week in, I believe, New York. So, all of these different events leading to one inescapable conclusion, which is that the law enforcement and justice systems in this country have a severe problem with institutional racism. The media coverage of all this has basically devolved to how bad are the riots going to be. And that is part of the problem. Part of the problem is that we're not talking about the actual issues in this. We're talking once again about how do we control those icky people out there who are complaining that too much violence is being used against them. Well, we control them by using that much more violence against them. And I am concerned that it could get ugly this weekend or early next week when the news hits, and they're probably going to control the timing to do it as close to the holidays as possible, when the weather is as bad as possible, et cetera. And we're probably going to see an overwhelming show of law enforcement force, not just in St. Louis, but in major cities across the country, including Seattle. We'll see how it plays out.
So translation on prioritizing the preservation of human life is we're going to try really hard not to kill anyone?
Well, yeah, except that I don't know that trying hard is what they're saying. They're saying they're going to prioritize it, which, they'll define that however they like.
Gotcha. All right. Also, this week getting a lot of media attention, as well as attention in the Senate and Congress, was President Obama putting out an executive order regarding immigration.
Yeah, and I was really struck listening Thursday night. It was Thursday night. Maybe it was Wednesday. I think it was Thursday night to Obama's original speech on this. No, it was Wednesday night to his speech on immigration. How defensive he was in his presentation of this, saying, "Yeah, I know they broke the law, and it's true this and it's true that, but it's the right thing to do. And besides, it's not really practical to arrest 5 million people. And we want to be fair. We want to give people opportunity because, people were brought here as kids through no fault of their own, et cetera." And it was just a remarkably defensive speech, I thought. And then you saw the comments, and you saw, things like comment threads in the different different media accounts of it, and you saw the coverage in places like Fox News, which was as egregiously racist as anything I've seen in mainstream media and basically my adult life. And I grew up in the South in the 60s, so, I've seen racist. It really is incredibly bad. And it again devolves to basically the same thing. The nation prepares to be overhoarded by angry hordes of brown people. Now, what Obama is doing is completely within his authority, and not only within his authority, but given that Congress has been refusing to act, and in particular, the Republican leadership of the House of Representatives has been refusing to allow a vote on an immigration package that not only passed the Senate 2 years ago, but which, because it has bipartisan support, people believe it would pass the House of Representatives were it allowed to come up for a vote. But the leadership under Boehner, essentially being held hostage to the more nativist strains of their own party, have not allowed it to come up for a vote. And so Obama is saying, well, if Congress isn't going to act, and Congress, of course, has not acted on a good many things over the past couple of years and won't over the next couple either, then I'm going to act on my own. And what he is doing is not changing the law, because he can't do that. Only Congress can do that. What he is doing is saying that as long as I am president, which is to say over the next couple of years, I am not going to enforce deportations of the law against this particular class of people. Now, the problem with that is that the condition under which he's offering to do it is by people coming forward and identifying themselves and saying, you know, I've been here the requisite 5 years, et cetera. And the problem with that is that for people who have been trying to avoid federal authorities for probably most of their lives, to then go and give the federal government information on who you are and where you are and your history and all the rest of that, when that executive order could be overturned in 2 years by a Republican president if they are if they're elected in 2016. And at that point, you are, in fact, at risk of getting immediately deported, or at least the federal government trying to do that, because that law still is on the books. So it's not clear to me at a practical level how effective this is going to be, because a lot of people who are affected by this order still have very good reason to be afraid, given how vicious the backlash has been in the past couple of days, and given how clear the intent is of the Republican Party to try and try and make this as white a country as possible, really, but to try and deport as many people as they can. And this, of course, masks that under the Obama administration, deportations already have been at a record level over the past 6 years. So I'm not sure how effective it will be pragmatically. At a symbolic level, of course, it was very welcome news. It was widely celebrated in Latino community and human rights communities. We'll see if this is impetus for trying to pass any kind of comprehensive immigration reform. But realistically, it's going to be a draw until after the 2016 elections, unless Congress, and once again, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, the budget process for the next couple of years is going to be controlled by the Republican Party. Democrats cannot propose a budget at this point. All they can do is block pieces of the budget they don't like. Wouldn't surprise me if the Republican Party made funding for things like border control conditional on deporting those folks, if they tried to force the government's hand into using the budget purse strings to demand that this class of folks be eligible for deportation after all. So we'll see how this plays out. But once again, it's going to be another flashpoint for confrontation between Republicans and Obama.
All right. Moving on. Friday news dump, a report we've all been waiting for.
Yeah. And this is the classic news, not just a Friday evening news dump, but a Friday evening news dump when between immigration and Ferguson, there's two other huge national news stories going on. And it's a short holiday week coming up as well. Daryl Issa's Republican run House Intelligence Committee, after 2 years and six previous investigations, released its comprehensive report on Benghazi last night. And its report concluded that there was really nothing going on at all. Never mind. The CIA and the military acted properly in responding to the 2012 attack on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya. It found no wrongdoing by the Obama administration appointees. Specifically, there was no intelligence failure. There was no delay in sending a CIA rescue team. There was no missed opportunity for a military rescue. There was no evidence the CIA was covertly shipping arms from Libya to Syria. In the immediate aftermath of the attack, intelligence about who carried it out and why was contradictory, the report found. That led Susan Rice, who was then the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., to inaccurately say the attack had evolved from a protest. But it was intelligence analysts, not political appointees, who had made that wrong call, and there was no evidence that Rice or any other government official acted in bad faith in passing on that erroneous information. In other words, and of course, Rice's career was basically destroyed over this. In other words, all of that heat and fury and all those investigations and all that taxpayer money was all about nothing. And of course, literally the day after the right wing heads are exploding over the immigration executive order is when they currently slip this in that, oh, by the way, the previous outrage that we were hyperventilating about and going to impeach the president over was all about nothing. And we knew this. We knew this at the end of 2012. We knew it when Leon Panetta and various other officials at the head of the State Department and the CIA came before Congress and testified that this was all nonsense. It should have been put to rest then. It was primarily media coverage and Republican officials lying that kept this alive for 2 years. And now those same Republican officials are saying, never mind, there was nothing here. We are a nation of suckers. But, you know, they got what they wanted. They now have control of Congress. And that was the whole point. That was the whole point.
All right. A couple of interesting Senate votes this week.
Yeah. And in both cases, the Senate failed to pass. They did pass, but not by the 60 votes that was needed to avoid the now routine filibuster, failed to pass legislation, one of which would have been good, that being a reform effort to limit the surveillance powers of the NSA, one of which would have been bad, which was an effort by the Senate to demand passage of the Keystone XL pipeline. The Keystone XL vote, particularly notable because they only fell one vote short of that, 59, and they needed 60 to avoid cloture on the filibuster. And, of course, there will be four more Republicans in the Senate after January. Now, three of the Democrats who crossed over in order to vote for Keystone XL from oil-producing states, such as Mark Begich in Alaska, did not win re-election and will be replaced by Republicans. So Republicans will have at least 60 votes come January to consider such legislation again. So we're going to see this in the Senate again, and then it's going to be up to President Obama whether to veto or not veto that legislation and whether to give the green light to Keystone or not. The NSA, on the other hand, there were a few Republicans that crossed the line in order to vote for reform to the NSA, but it was primarily the Republicans who voted in favor of the surveillance state. So next time you hear them talking about opposing intrusive government, just remember that.
All right. Also this week, some developments with California's prison population.
Yeah. A federal appeals court demanding last week that that California reduce its prison population in accordance with a 2010 U.S. Supreme Court decision. But what was particularly interesting about this was the argument used by the state of California, a relatively novel argument in its ongoing effort to try to avoid reducing its prison population. Their argument this time from the California Attorney General's office was that they couldn't afford to reduce the prison population, not because of logistics, not because it would let dangerous criminals loose on the street, but because they're reliant on the slave labor of inmate labor in order to provide firefighters to fight forest fires. And without that slave labor, they can't afford to effectively fight the forest fires and therefore endanger public safety. And it really underscores once again, not even with the states, let alone with the private prison industry, how reliant the prison industrial complex has become on essentially slave labor, inmate slave labor, and inducing inmates to what in this case is a pretty dangerous job, that is fighting forest fires, in order to try and get reductions in their prison sentences. It really once again highlights how utterly corrupt and how profit-driven our incarceration policies have become in this country.
Which segues perfectly to news this week that Albert Woodfox of the Angola 3 is out of solitary confinement.
Yeah, and not just out of solitary confinement, but Woodfox actually had his conviction overturned 43 years after originally being convicted for the murder of a prison guard in 1972. Woodfox had his conviction finally overturned for the second time, mind you. It was originally overturned in 1993. He was then reindicted after an earlier court had overturned his sentence, reindicted by a grand jury with a white foreperson, and that conviction overturned by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals this week, finding that the selection of the white foreperson formed part of a systematically discriminatory pattern in Louisiana in that era, concluding that it amounted to a violation of the U.S. Constitution. So Woodfox's conviction was overturned. He had spent 40 of the last 43 years in solitary confinement, 23 hours a day in a 6x8 cell and the other hour a day also by himself in a equally small exercise, quote-unquote, yard. This is a man who was punished by what any human rights organization considers torture for over 40 years. And as it turns out, convicted wrongly. He was protested his innocence the entire time. And claimed that was a political vendetta owing out of his membership then in the Black Panther Party along with his co-defendants. That certainly not a surprise to anybody as knows history from that part of our history, our era. But once again, we have a whole generation, a couple generations now of people who are finding this kind of punitive solitary confinement as something that is routinely done in our prison system. And this case highlights once again and highlights, as does Ferguson, how not just institutional racism, but also torture and all kinds of cruelty is at the heart of our justice system in this country.
And it seems like on a weekly basis, we're hearing about people being released from prison for completely bogus charges who have either been on death row or been in there for decades.
Yeah. And now a lot of these have come in recent years because of the prevalence of DNA testing. And there are still an awful lot of those cases where, because their appeals process had already been exhausted, they can't get DNA tests at this point. But it once again underscores how between the use of plea bargains and coercing people into plea bargains and unreliable eyewitness testimony and the institutional racism that I spoke of, how a lot of these convictions were deeply problematic and continue to be deeply problematic, it really does raise, as does Ferguson, some fundamental questions about the fairness of our justice system.
All right. And just about a minute to mention that it looks like the war in Afghanistan is being extended.
Yeah, and this, mind you, I found in the Guardian newspaper. I did not find it in U.S. media, but U.S. officials are very quietly saying now that President Obama in recent weeks has issued executive orders to quietly approve guidelines to change the status of the U.S. forces that will be left in Afghanistan after the expiration of the Status of Forces Agreement at the end of this year in Afghanistan. The terms under which the Pentagon can target Taliban fighters in Afghanistan are changing and broadening the previous plans. Those plans had previously limited the military to counterterrorism missions after Al-Qaeda after this year, but the decisions will now allow the military to conduct air support for Afghan operations when needed and also engage in combat themselves when I guess they feel like it, basically. But it really, again, underscores the seemingly permanent state of war that we have fallen into under the war on terror and our Nobel Peace Prize winning president.
All right. Events.
As we mentioned, the grand jury decision on Ferguson is coming up any day now, possibly this weekend, more likely probably on Monday. But whenever it does happen, the day of that decision, 6 o'clock Pacific time that evening, protesters will be meeting in Westlake Park downtown at 4th and Pine Street to protest and probably march and make some noise. And by all means, bring some water bottles and some things to deal with tear gas and pepper spray, because somehow I don't think that Seattle police are going to be very kindly disposed toward those particular protests. So there's that. Also, this coming up on Monday, the city council is giving its final vote on the 2015 budget. We talked a couple of weeks ago about how amendments to that budget that passed reinforce the $15 an hour minimum wage and do some other good things. So it's basically a pretty positive budget at this point. But the final vote on that will be Monday at 2 p.m. City Council Chambers at 5th and James. So stop in there and encourage your city council people to vote the right way on that.